Today's show is going to be a real trip. We are talking about the Cambrian creature, Hallucigenia. This episode, we talk about the legendary Burgess Shale, get down with worms, and discuss the benefits of using a punk aesthetic for self-defense. Pals in Paleo presents Hallucigenia. Let's go back in time, let's explore, and see what we can find. This is Pals in Paleo, the show where we discuss the form, function, and family groupings of extinct animals and other organisms. I'm your host, paleontologist, PhD student, and fossil enthusiast Adele Pentland. You can keep up to date with the show by following Pals in Paleo on Instagram, and feel free to message me, especially if you have something nice to say. But any constructive criticism can be sent to our podcast producer and editor, Caesar on Safari. Just kidding, but kind of not really. Please be nice to me. I'm only human and I'm doing my best. Without further ado, let's get weird and talk about Hallucigenia. Pals in Paleo acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This episode was recorded on Koa Country in Winton, Central Western Queensland, and fossils of Hallucigenia are known from sites across Canada and China. I wanted to do some follow-ups from our last episode, which was on Arena Erpeton with special guest Lachlan Hart. Okay, first off the bat, let's talk about the plural for the word platypus. A platypus, by the way, is a monotreme, which is an egg-laying mammal we have here in Australia. And as Lachlan mentioned, they swim around in the water, but they also spend time on land. They're weird, they're great, we love them, and they're on the 20-cent coin in our Australian currency. Anyway, you might remember Lachlan wasn't sure what the plural of platypus was, and neither was I. This actually popped up the other day when I was listening to Just the Zoo of Us with Ellen and Christian Weatherford. So how plurals do is based on the language that word is based off of. So in English, you add an S onto the end of a word to make it its plural form. It's actually the same with Portuguese, which I'm currently learning, or trying to learn, I should say, because I'm going on a little upcoming trip to Brazil. I don't think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but yeah, I'll be going for a very short time with my supervisor, Dr. Steve Poropat, as well as Professor Cleedy Grice. So I did end up joining the Curtin Lab. Cannot remember if I mentioned that in a past episode. And we're all going to go over together, hopefully try and collect some fossils, all above board, have our paperwork like ticked and signed off. And I'm so excited. It's going to be so much fun. There's obviously a lot of very cool pterosaur fossils in Brazil for me to look at, as well as, yeah, just a whole other country, and can't wait. But getting back to the platypus. So since platypus has Greek origins, the plural is platypuses or platypodes. I personally prefer platypuses, but that's just me. I also need to acknowledge that when I said in the Arena Erpeton episode, anything with a mouth can bite you, I was actually quoting something that Christian from Just the Zoo of Us says all the time. Apparently, when he was a kid, someone who worked at a pet store said that to him, and it's like a core memory. But yeah, it comes up every now and then on Just the Zoo of Us, and I wanted to cite the original source. So not only did we talk about the plural of platypus, but Lachlan also mentioned Paracyclitosaurus, the Australian temnospondyl that got shipped off to the British Museum of Natural History. So my supervisor for my PhD, Dr. Steve Poropat, who you'll be hearing from in an upcoming episode, he had a listen to the show and let me know about a new paper that had just come out. Different type of paper to what we normally talk about here on the show. That one was published by Alan Ricks in the Royal Society of Queensland, and it's entitled The Dunstan Deals, How Some Geological Treasures Left Australia. So Benjamin Dunstan was the chief government geologist of Queensland from 1908 until 1931. And when he died, his personal collection of fossils and rocks, including some meteorites, was sold to the Natural History Museum in London. Even though the Parasyclitosaurus holotype specimen was something Dunstan collected himself, it's a bummer to think that he didn't donate it before he passed away. As for the meteorites, though, that whole debacle definitely does not pass the pub test. He did wrong. He shouldn't have done that. Anyway, I could go on and on, but if you're interested in reading more on that, The Dunstan Deals, published by Alan Ricks, is available in open access, and I'll chuck a link to that paper in the show notes. Last follow-up I had was on the cool paleo art by friend of the show, designer, cartoonist, Zev Lands. Zev is doing the art for the Bass Coast Dinosaur Trail down in Victoria, and he's been cranking out some really fun fan art. So far, he's drawn Cryolophosaurus from episode 5, Dunkleosteus, which we talked about in number 6, and Arena Herpeton from our last episode. Of all the ones he's done so far, Arena Herpeton's definitely my favorite. You can check out his stuff on Instagram at Zev Lands. Lands is spelt L-A-N-D-E-S, but I also repost a lot of his stuff on the Pals in Paleo Instagram, so you can find him that way. By the way, if you or someone you know uses Pals in Paleo as like a creative prompt to create paleo art based on our episodes, please tag me, because otherwise I might not see it. And yeah, it just makes me really happy to think that you're engaging with the episodes. Today, we're heading back to the no-bone zone to talk about an invertebrate like no other. Hallucigenia really does live up to its name. It looks more like something you'd stumble across in a fever dream or if you smoke some bad granola, rather than a fossil found in the Canadian Rockies or the Cambrian of China. We'll get into it in a moment, but before we hear about Hallucigenia, I cannot wait to tell you about today's random fossil fact. If this is your first time listening to Pals in Paleo, we do things different around here, and instead of discussing and dissecting the news, you get to hear me bang on about weird and wonderful research on a host of different topics. Most of the time, it's stuff I learned about years ago and have squirreled away in the back of my mind. So it's not necessarily new research, but it is extraordinary and still super exciting. Today's random fossil fact is on de-extinction of a fossil plant. If you're not familiar with the term de-extinction, it's essentially what the scientists in Jurassic Park were doing, bringing a species back after it's already gone extinct. It's something that's coming up more and more these days, since teams of scientists around the world are working to resurrect things like the dodo, the thylacine, and the woolly mammoth. Of the three animal species I just mentioned, two of those were definitely hunted to extinction by humans. So attempting to bring them back, well, it kind of feels like it's been motivated by guilt, you know, trying to make amends and fix the mistakes of the past. There's the argument that by reintroducing these animals into areas they once lived, order is being restored and their ecosystems are back in balance. But of course, it's much more complicated than that. And there's a lot to consider both ethically and ecologically. I'm not going to get into the ethics of whether or not we should revive extinct species of animal, but if you're interested, Just the Zoo of Us, another podcast hosted by the delightful Ellen and Christian Weatherford, they talk about the pros and cons of de-extinction and the thylacine as well. If you want to check out that episode, it's number 185, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. They normally talk about extant species of animals on their show, but they talked about the megalodon, the biggest species of shark to ever live, and the thylacine for a special episode. Getting back to our random fossil fact, though, it's a lot easier to revive something that isn't that old. Kind of like eating something after the best before date. You're better off eating something that's a couple days out of date rather than months after it's expired. Theoretically, of course. I mean, I would never tell you to eat food that's expired. This is just between me and you, smashed hat. All this to say, The fresher the genetic material, the easier it is to work with, because less of it has broken down, so there's more of it to work with. And if it's been kept on ice for thousands of years, that's even better. Like the de-extinction of the woolly mammoth, these specimens were collected from Siberian permafrost, which is honestly a bit of a goldmine when it comes to preserving genetic material in extinct organisms. This paper was published by Svetlana Yashina and a team of Russian scientists in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2012. So in the 10 plus years since these fossil plants were revived, we have not had the Day of the Triffids. Like, these plants did not then mutate and take over the world, which is good to know. The paper, by the way, is titled Regeneration of Whole Fertile Plants from 30,000-Year-Old Fruit Tissue Buried in Siberian Permafrost. That paper is in open access, so anyone can read it. And if you're interested, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. What I found interesting about these specimens is that they weren't just in a random layer of sediment. They had actually been stashed in the burrows of fossil squirrels. And as soon as I read that, all I could think about was Scrat from Ice Age. And I forgot to check, but I'm fairly certain these weren't saber-toothed squirrels. The burrows themselves were used for hibernation and filled with hundreds of thousands of seed samples from a bunch of different species of plant. The squirrel burrows containing the special plant sample were 38 meters below ground, which is almost 125 feet, and they were preserved in late Pleistocene permafrost that had never been melted. Again, it's better to eat food that has been kept consistently cool rather than reaching for something after you've had a power outage for a couple days. These fruits are 31,800 years old, give or take 300 years. I know, it's nice to have exact numbers, but in the rare instances when you're actually able to work out the age of something using radioisotopes, there's always an error bar, which is why I said give or take 300 years. This is often written down as plus or minus however many years. This is also why some news articles discussing this paper said the fruit tissue was 32,000 years old. They just rounded it up to a nice, neat number. All this to say, the plants they grew were a lot older than the previous record holder. Before this, scientists had successfully grown date palms dating back to 2,000 years ago. I'll also put a link to that study in the show notes, but safe to say, the Siberian material has it beat hands down. For tens of thousands of years, the Siberian permafrost has kept this plant material at an average of minus 7 degrees Celsius, which is 19.4 degrees Fahrenheit, so freezing cold. The plants were grown from maternal, immature fruit tissue from the late Pleistocene, and from that, they were able to grow the herbaceous plant Silene stenophylla. Or that's what they thought they had at first, but more on that in a minute. This team of researchers actually first attempted to revive this plant using germinated fruits, but when that didn't work out, they were still able to get the results they wanted using immature fruits instead. Not only were they able to grow healthy plants, these flowered and set fruit themselves, producing viable seeds. So again, this has broader implications for de-extinction proper and resurrecting breeding populations of an entire species, not just one individual. By the way, if you want to see what this plant looks like, I'll also link to an ABC article summarizing this research. But to paint you a picture of what this very dainty plant looks like, it's pretty small and has white flowers with five petals. It actually reminds me a lot of the plant Princess Zelda loves so much in Breath of the Wild. But from memory, that one had a splash of blue and the leaves were a bit different. Now, since that original research article was published in 2012, there have been some follow-up papers. These have all been focused on nailing down the taxonomy of this species of plant. In 2012, the same year that first paper was published, a different team of researchers stated that the shape of the leaves and other features of the clones were most similar to Silene linneana. So, same genus but different species. Then, shortly after that, the original team of researchers wrote a reply and acknowledged that whilst they had some good points, molecular data was needed to settle things once and for all. Then, for almost a decade, the identity of these plant clones was up in the air until findings were published in 2022 by another team of Russian scientists, this time led by Tatiana Kramina. Kramina and colleagues used molecular markers to determine that these were, in fact, S. linaeana. And if you want to read those papers, again, they'll all be in the show notes and they're all in open access. Since Silene linaeana is still around today and grows in Siberia, I guess technically this doesn't count as de-extinction. Still, it's very cool and uses the same principles as de-extinction. Sorry if this counts as clickbait, but I was just desperate to talk about this amazing ancient plant and all the research that's been done on it. We've heard about cloning plants from the late Pleistocene, which again was about 32,000 years ago, but we're about to go further back in time and into the ocean more than 500 million years ago and deep dive into the delightfully weird Cambrian critter Hallucigenia. Before we talk about the form, function, and family tree of Hallucigenia, let's set the scene so we can better understand this crazy-looking creature. Hallucigenia is from the Middle Cambrian, so about 508 million years ago, give or take a few million years. As you might have guessed, the further back in time you go, the less recognizable things become. Kind of like hopping in the car and things slowly changing and becoming less familiar. Well, unless you live in Europe or something like that, in which case things can completely change if you head in the right direction. But you know what I'm trying to say here. When scientists first stumbled across this little oddball, they couldn't work out which way was up or how to tell the difference between the head and the butt end of the animal. Well, actually, that's not entirely true. But the first interpretation had this animal upside down and back to front. So, yeah. And as it turns out, until about 10 years ago, they were actually missing the head. Initially, scientists thought this little worm had a balloon-shaped head, but on closer inspection, what they were looking at was fossil goo that had been squished out of the animal after it was buried and during the fossilization process. In fact, the head was on the other end of the animal, and this interpretation has been bolstered by the identification of eyes and a mouth at this end, but more on that in a minute. It just goes to show that one fossil can completely change our understanding of a species or even an entire group of animals. As of this recording, there are three species of Hallucigenia. So Hallucigenia sparsis, Hallucigenia fortis, and Hallucigenia hongmei. As I mentioned at the top of the episode, fossils of Hallucigenia have been found in the Canadian Rockies and in southern China. These two localities were close to each other in the Cambrian, which is something that we talked about in the episode on Anomalocaris. So if you haven't already, listen to that episode and you'll get what I mean. Even though there are three species of Hallucigenia, I'm going to give you a general description of the animal, but we'll also be hearing from Dr. Martin Smith, a paleontologist at the University of Durham, and his research largely focuses on Hallucigenia sparsis from the Burgess Shale. So just keep that in mind. Okay, I know I've been hyping Hallucigenia up as being super strange, but honestly, there is nothing that looks anything like it alive today. In terms of what Hallucigenia looks like, imagine a worm-like creature doing its best impression of a singer from a punk rock band, and you're halfway there. Hallucigenia isn't a big animal, but they do range in size. The smallest are about half a centimeter to 5.5 centimeters long, which is equal to a fifth of an inch to just over 2 inches. So itty-bitty little animals. If you traveled back in time to the Cambrian, you might accidentally squish one of these little creatures and not even realize. Well, depending on whether you step on the spiky side or not, but more on that in a minute. I couldn't find a weight estimate for Hallucigenia, but we know about how big it is, and it's a thin, tube-shaped animal with some other jazz going on, so it wouldn't have been super heavy. I probably should have also mentioned this earlier, but this worm-like animal also has legs. The maximum number of legs is 10, So different to centipedes and millipedes, which are types of myriapods, but they evolved a lot later in Earth history. Most of the time, the legs on segmented animals are uniform. Like, you've seen one, you've seen them all. Unless they're right next to the face, in which case they might be a little bit shorter and more maneuverable, especially if that animal is a predator. Hallucigenia didn't get the memo. So starting at the head, the front end of the animal, the first two or three sets of legs near the head are thin, like spaghetti. And from what it looks like, they're very flexible. The remaining seven or eight pairs of legs are a little thicker and end in either one or two claws on each foot, depending on the species. As it turns out, the claws were one of several features that helped researchers, most notably Dr. Martin Smith, work out how Hallucigenia fits into the animal kingdom.
So I'm Martin Smith. I'm a paleontologist at the University of Durham in the UK.
Dr. Smith is a top-tier paleontologist who has published his research on Hallucigenia in Nature and is the head of his own research lab at the University of Durham. He oversees work on ancient invertebrates, especially animals from the Cambrian. If you're interested in reading what else the Smith lab works on, I'll put a link to their website in the show notes. Now, because Hallucigenia is so small, it takes a high-powered microscope, a scanning electron microscope, to really be able to see the finer features of this animal, which is precisely what Dr. Martin Smith set out to do.
So when we took the Hallucigenia specimens over to the electron microscope, we weren't really sure what we were going to find. We'd already had some interesting observations of the spines along the back of the organism that we wanted to follow up on. But we thought, well, whilst we're here, we really need to have a proper look all over. When we'd been looking previously at the claws, we'd been amazed at how much exquisite detail there was that was actually preserved. And there's a ton of specimens. There's a few dozen. And you hold them to the light and you just see something glinting and you think, there's something happening here. So we wanted to have a look at the eyes and to understand exactly how they were put together. Well, it was amazing, really. The first specimen that I put into the chamber, I closed the machine, I waited for it to roll up, and just sort of smiling back at me is this little face, these two little eyes, and what looks like a big toothy grin. Well, it's not quite a toothy grin. That's part of a ring of spines that would have surrounded its mouth. And then dot, 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 all the way along its guts are these little black flecks that don't really look like anything we've seen before. And they were completely unexpected. But once we saw them, we thought, hang on, there's a correlation to be made here. There's a connection to the throats and the amounts of other organisms within this group that contains the arthropods and the velvet worms. And in fact, that allows us to draw some connections between Hallucigenia and the very origin of this larger group that contains all those living creatures.
I don't know what's more surprising, the fact that Hallucigenia has teeth or a pair of eyes. The teeth were also a bit of a surprise to the paleontologists working on these fossils.
We hadn't been expecting to find teeth at all in Hallucigenia. To some extent, that's because nobody suggested that any features like that were present in these lobopodians, which looked like very simple organisms at first glance. And secondly, it's because there are really similar features in herbal worms, in their living descendants. So what we're looking at here is a vestige of the ancestral morphology that is still preserved in Hallucigenia, was lost later in the evolutionary trajectory. And whilst we were surprised at first, whilst we thought about this, we thought, well, actually, yes, this does make a degree of sense. It's not as if something wakes up one day and loses all of its evolutionary heritage and comes up with a completely new body plan. And so having these teeth here shows us that Hallucigenia is an intermediate. It's got some of the old features. It's got some of the new features. It's somewhere in between. It's showing us this gradual pathway from spine-covered worm to something as derived and unusual as a modern velvet worm.
If you're not familiar with velvet worms, don't worry, I'll talk about them when we get to Hallucigenia's family grouping, but for now, just picture a small worm living in the rainforest. Like Martin mentioned before, even though at a first glance, Hallucigenia looked like it had a smiley face, its teeth are actually arranged in a ring.
The dentition of Hallucigenia comprises a ring of spines that go around where the mouth was, to put it simply. It would have probably been used to sort of suck food in. And then once the food gets into the mouth and into the throat, it's got these little needle-like spines along the top of the throat that presumably would have stopped food coming back out again and directed it down into the stomach and the digestive region.
Pals and Paleo will be right back. This episode is brought to you by Dinosaur Trips. Dinosaur trips are exactly what they sound like. Each itinerary gets you up close and personal with experts and gives you backstage access into the world of paleontology, visiting museums from across the world, and even getting you onto real-life dinosaur digs. There's a bunch of trips running in 2024. Alberta Badlands and Beyond is back, and so's Badlands Family Adventure. Personally, I'm eyeing off the trip to Arizona and California because I'm dying to see the La Brea tar pits, but then again, I'm also tempted to travel to Patagonia. To learn more about the 2024 trips, you can check out their website, dinosaurtrips.com, and sign up to their newsletter to be the first to find out about the new trips. And you can email Zach on zach@dinosaurtrips.com, and Zach is spelled Z-A-C-H. It's been 66 million years. Why wait any longer? Join Dinosaur Trips on the adventure of a lifetime. Some fossils from the Burgess Shale are so well preserved, they can actually make out what the internal anatomy of this animal was like, and it looks like they had a simple gut. So nothing fancy, but food goes in the mouth and exits out the other end, which in my opinion is better than the alternative. Aside from its mouth, the only other feature on Hallucigenia's head are a pair of simple eyes. Simple eyes in invertebrates are sometimes called eye spots or ocelli, but they're all names for the same thing. Ocelli, by the way, is spelt O-C-E-L-L-I. Good Scrabble word. Which are what jellyfish, sea stars, flatworms, snails and slugs, and some arthropods use to see. I just had a thought. You know how Ditto, the Pokemon Ditto, that pink squishy blob, always has dot eyes, even when it transforms into other Pokemon? I reckon Ditto has ocelli, and that it can change other parts of its body, but it can't change its eyes. Probably not canon, but sounds good. Anyway, the ocelli are better than nothing, but as Dr. Martin Smith explains, these eye spots wouldn't have helped Hallucigenia see things in detail.
Yeah, Hallucigenia's eyes were pit eyes. They were reasonably simple ocelli, we'd call them. They were probably able to form a basic image. They were pretty large in comparison to the size of its head, but it probably wasn't going to benefit from an HD TV screen. Yeah, his vision would have been pretty blurry, but certainly good enough to tell the predator was coming.
Honestly, as long as it gives you a bit of an idea when a predator is around, then those eyes are doing their job. And of course, the other thing you can do to protect yourself from predators is to shield yourself from their attack or fight back. Hallucigenia has a series of spikes running along its back, which are quite long compared to the rest of the body, and in the early days, these were mistakenly identified as Hallucigenia's legs. And with that, let's talk about function and spitball some ideas about what Hallucigenia was doing with its body. The spikes along Hallucigenia's back were almost certainly used for self-defense. Similarly, we see some caterpillars today adopting the same strategy, using spikes and other deterrents to ward off potential predators. This is particularly useful if you have predators trying to swoop at you from above. Me personally, I hate picking prickles out of my socks, and it's kind of the same principle with Hallucigenia. Predators are less likely to want to eat something that will hurt them as they're grabbing it, especially if they don't have an easy way of avoiding or removing those spines. I forgot to mention when I was describing the form of Hallucigenia, the spines aren't sticking straight up like a mohawk. Instead, they occur in pairs along the back and stick out at a bit of an angle. This makes a lot more sense than a single row of spines, since pairs of spikes that stick upwards and outwards will offer a bit more protection. The spines were quite stiff as well, so if something did try to grab them, it'll do some piercing damage. They're also very tall compared to the rest of the body. It's worth noting that lots of different animals have evolved spines and quills, and plants have also evolved spines and thorns. And of course, they can be made up of different things. Since Hallucigenia has, for the most part, legs that end in claws, despite the fact that it's living in the ancient oceans of the Cambrian, it probably wasn't swimming around. Instead, those claws probably helped it get a grip as it walked along the ocean floor. The claws aren't super massive, and even things like flies and other insects have legs that end in claws. So again, this was probably an evolutionary adaptation that helped Hallucigenia move around more than anything else. I mentioned before, when giving a general description of Hallucigenia, that the first two or three pairs of appendages closest to the head are much thinner than the other legs, and they also lack claws entirely. It's still a bit of a mystery as to what these were used for. During our conversation, I had guessed that these helped Hallucigenia feed, like the raptorial appendages that the praying mantis has. If you look closely at a mantis, the legs closest to the mouth are different from the rest and used to hold and manipulate prey. But as Martin explains, this probably isn't the case for Hallucigenia, and the true purpose of these flexible tentacles is a bit unclear.
But were those really thin tentacles really up to the task of weaving food around? There's a bit of a question mark as to what they were doing. Were they sensorial? It's a bit hard to tell.
So maybe these tentacles helped Hallucigenia feel its way around? It seems we still have a lot to learn about this incredible creature, but one of the most recent revelations has been how Hallucigenia fits into the tree of life. We've heard about form and function. Now let's get into the family grouping of this spiky noodle. Broadly speaking, Hallucigenia belongs to Panarthropoda, which is a big group that is mostly made up of arthropods plus two other comparatively smaller clades. The big one is arthropods, which includes insects, arachnids, scorpions and ticks, as well as crustaceans. If something has an exoskeleton or a crunchy outer layer and needs to molt, chances are it's an arthropod. There are at least a million species of arthropods alive on Earth today, so they're incredibly important in today's ecosystems. But let's not forget there are two other clades included within Panarthropoda. This includes tardigrades, which are also known as water bears, and velvet worms. Tardigrades are very small and range from 0.5 millimeter to 1.2 millimeters. That's equivalent to a 50th of an inch to a 25th of an inch. They're tiny. Tardigrades are able to enter a state of suspended animation and have survived the vacuum of space. Mind you, they're not living their best life when they're out there, but they can recover from it and continue living their lives. The last members of the Panarthropoda are the velvet worms, which, as the name suggests, they're small, tube-shaped animals with antennae, stubby legs, and they're covered in what looks like a fine fuzz. Velvet worms are only found today in damp places, including decaying logs and leaf litter. They look cute and harmless, but they actually hunt using slime and eat invertebrates. I'm not going to go into the details because it's actually kind of gruesome and reminds me of a horror movie if I watched them, but yeah, they're pretty weird and wonderful. If we zoom in, Hallucigenia is most closely related to modern velvet worms and fits within the phylum Onychophora. And as we've touched on before, at first glance, Hallucigenia looks quite strange, but there are hints of its heritage hidden in plain sight.
Hallucigenia's got a score of 10 out of 10. It's completely crazy. It looks a little bit ridiculous, and that's hardly why I love it. At the same time, once you start to realise what all these strange characteristics are, it does sort of make sense. And it does fit into this pattern of diversity that's just been winnowed out by extinction. And, you know, who knows, if the Grim Reaper's scythe had fallen on a slightly different set of organisms, maybe the rainforest today would be crawling with things that look just like Hallucigenia. And we'd be looking at things that look like modern velvet worms and thinking, whoa, that's a 10 out of 10 for weirdness.
The other notes I have for the taxonomy of this animal is that Hallucigenia belongs to the clade of Hallucoscaniids and the order Hallucigeniidae. Honestly, I thought it was impressive enough when an animal had a whole family named after it, but this is next level. I mean, a clade with your name in it basically has the same energy as women being known by their first name only, like Beyonce, Cher, Oprah. So even though Hallucigenia isn't a household name, it's still iconic. Part of the reason why Hallucigenia is notable is because we have multiple fossils of this creature, and it's known from a few different sites across the globe, including the famous Burgess Shale. Western scientists first became familiar with the fossils from the Burgess Shale in 1909 when Charles Walcott came across the site. As far as fossil localities go, it was basically like winning the lottery. Not only are the fossils preserved in fine-grained sediment, which helps capture a lot of detail, as we've already heard, it was full of incredible animals.
It lives at a very interesting time in life history. If we go back another 50 million years, then there's not really much living in the oceans that's more complicated than a seaweed. There's a few little wormy things, maybe. But you fast forward 10, 15 million years, and almost all of the modern body plans, the sort of ways of building an organism, have appeared in the fossil records. So hallucigenia is living at this time where the evolution is really something sort of creative masterstroke, if you like. Lots of innovation is happening. And so we're seeing this combination in fossil deposits like the Burgess Shale, where hallucigenia is preserved, of organisms that are starting to look quite similar to modern groups, but also some of those more ancestral morphologies, yeah, the dead ends, the side alleys, that didn't make it through subsequent extinctions and so now look quite strange to modern eyes.
Over the course of 14 years, Walcott, with his family in tow, would collect hundreds of fossils from the Burgess Shale. By the end of this saga in 1924, when Walcott was 74 years old, he had collected 65,000 specimens. I'm genuinely struggling to deal with how big that number is, because honestly, that'd have to be up there with the number of fossils in some museums. I can understand where he was coming from and why he did it, though, because the Burgess Shale is famous for the high quality of its fossils. By the way, it's not like Walcott single-handedly pilfered every single fossil from this site. More fossils had been found since that time. Still, it's safe to say that Walcott bit off a little more than he could chew. He tried his best to get through and describe as many fossils as he could, something he pursued up until he died in 1927. Walcott laid the foundation work for future paleontologists, but he actually severely underestimated the diversity of the Burgess Shale fossil record. Part of that is because as he was describing these specimens, as if they had died only a couple years ago, he was trying to fit these square pegs within the round holes of modern taxonomy. What it boils down to is that some extinct groups are so far removed from everything we have around us today that they need their own special categories. It wasn't until the mid-1960s when other researchers started going through Walcott's work, they realized just how many different species they were actually dealing with. What's special about the Burgess Shale as a fossil locality is that it preserves soft-bodied organisms as well as the hard parts of the bodies. Most fossil localities just preserve the hard parts, and fossils of soft tissue structures are very rare. In fact, the exceptional quality of the fossils is the main reason why the Burgess Shale was designated a World Heritage Site in 1980. Then, 4 years later, it fell under the protection of the Canadian Rockies World Heritage status, which means you can't just walk in there and collect fossils. Anyone who does, hopefully, has gone through the proper checks and balances and obtained all the right permits. Getting back to the nitty-gritty details of the Burgess Shale, a shale is a very fine-grained sedimentary layer and indicates a low-energy depositional environment. Shales are essentially the bottom of the ocean, so even though the Burgess Shale is currently situated on top of a mountain and part of the Rockies in Canada, millions of years of geologic processes have shifted the position of this rock through orogenesis, which is the scientific name for mountain building, and things have been turned upside down. Or rather, two things have been pushed together, and as they've slammed into each other, these ancient sea sediments have been stacked on top of other sedimentary layers. The Burgess Shale is also famous for other fossil invertebrates, including our favourite Anomalocaris, trilobites, and other lovable weirdos, including Opabinia, an animal with five eyes, a segmented body, not too unlike a trilobite, and a trunk-like appendage at the front of its face. Before we wrap up, let's quickly talk about where you can learn more about hallucigenia and see if it's influenced pop culture. Unfortunately, there's not a lot to talk about with this creature in terms of movies and stuff like that. And it seems that no one wants to cuddle up next to a hallucigenia plushie, but it does come up on occasion when the Burgess Shale is mentioned. One of the earliest books written on the Burgess Shale was by Stephen Gould, titled Wonderful Life, and published in 1989. Keep in mind, though, we have learned a lot about fossils from the Burgess Shale since it was published, and a lot of that research has been fueled by advancements in technology. Getting back to that book, though, I just had a quick look online, and while there's some disagreement about the conclusions it comes to, I just want to put it out there, I haven't read this one myself. And I'll be honest, I'm not a big reader of books since undergrad, but if you have read it, I'm keen to hear what you thought of it. You can always DM me at palsinpaleo on Instagram. If you're like me and not much of a reader, but happy to watch a documentary, our good friend David Attenborough has you covered. Hallucigenia features in David Attenborough's First Life, which is a 2-hour exploration of Earth's first multicellular animals. Normally, I'm more than happy to recommend Attenborough to anyone, but bear in mind, this series came out in 2010, so 5 years before scientists had discovered Hallucigenia's missing head. So yeah, sadly, you can't believe everything you see on TV, but until David Attenborough revisits this time period, it'll have to do. Other than that, I found the Nature video with Dr. Martin Smith, who we heard from on today's episode, super informative. It's on YouTube, and if you want to check it out, that'll be in the show notes. It shows replicas of some of the Burgess Shale fossils, a close-up of the eyes and mouth of Hallucigenia, and a reconstruction of what Hallucigenia looked like when it was alive. That 3-minute video alone sums up just about everything we covered in this episode. Still, I hope you enjoyed hearing me talk about Hallucigenia. Thanks so much for listening, and a big Pals in Paleo thank you to Dr. Martin Smith, who responded to my very dorky email and was incredibly generous with his time. This episode wouldn't be nearly half as good without his input, and even though I was initially hesitant to have guests on for just about every episode, it's been wonderful hearing about research that's wildly different to what I'm working on and dive into different topics with the help of true experts in the field. As always, thank you so much for hanging out with me today, and if you've gone to the effort of listening to every single episode so far, from the very bottom of my heart, thank you. I'm having a lot of fun putting these together and working with my good mate Caesar. If you're still enjoying them and were willing and able, we'll keep making them and putting the show out there in some shape or form. We might need to take a break in between seasons, but we'll find a way to make it work, I promise. To keep up to date with the show and find out when the next episode drops, you can follow us on Instagram at palsinpaleo. Speaking of Caesar, the show literally wouldn't be what it is without his help. He produces the podcast, and he, along with my mate Grace, were the two people who really pepped me up to get this project up and going. Big thank you to Hello Kelly for our amazing theme music and the other tunes on the podcast. If you want to hear more Hello Kelly songs filled with synths and guitar riffs, definitely check out their latest album, Sweet Nostalgia, on Spotify, Bandcamp, and anywhere else you get music. Special thanks to Francie for editing our show and for also workshopping the podcast theme song with me. I had a rough idea of what it could be, but yeah, he took it to the next level and it sounds amazing. Final thank you goes out to Crumpet Clubhouse, especially Jenny Zhao and Amy Franks for our podcast cover art. Don't forget, you can get stickers with the podcast cover art and sticker sheets featuring the fossils. It's a great way to support the show and spread the word. Plus, you just get to treat yourself. So if you're interested in grabbing some of those, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. The next episode is the final one for season one. But don't worry, it's going to be an absolute cracker. I've spent ages working on it, and if it's not any good, at the very least, it's going to be a solid hour of content. If you liked today's show, don't forget you can rate and review us. Yes, it makes me smile, but more importantly, it helps us grow and connect with more people who want to learn about paleontology. Pals in Paleo will be back in 2 weeks' time with one last episode for season one, but until then, take it easy, and I'll talk to you soon.